Tired of hearing only one side of the story? Do you want news and information from people who, like you, know what it's like to work hard every day and still struggle to make ends meet? Then tune in to The Rick Smith Show every weeknight from 8 to 10 p.m. right here on the Civic Media Radio Network. Be part of the conversation. Tune in, turn on, and take back the American dream. The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
As Goes Wisconsin with Kristen Bry.
And apparently, Maggie Dawn, Fig Newton lover of the Maggie Dawn Show.
I was so offended, Jane. You know how much I love and admire you. You're like my freaking radio hero. And then to hear you bash my Newton.
It's still bad.
You want the cakey part cakey. You want the jammy part jammy. That is like bringing me back.
As Goes Wisconsin with host Kristen Bry. Weekdays 10 till noon on your local Civic Media radio station and on the Civic Media app. Direct from the Dairy State. It's Sharp Cheddar Weekends. A 3-hour block of Wisconsin-produced radio, Saturdays and Sundays from 11 a.m. till 2 p.m., featuring Raised in Wisco with Joe Clayfish and Danielle Fairman, The Cripes Cast with Charlie Behrens, and Under the Helmet with the Gravedigger, Gilbert Brown. You can enjoy it by the slice or enjoy the whole darn thing. Sharp Cheddar Weekends is radio so fresh, it squeaks. Listen in on the Civic Media station or on the app. The Todd Alba Show.
I see the silhouette of Todd Alba, who still hasn't figured out that maybe a TV person could help, you know, set this whole thing up.
For whatever reason, yeah. StreamYard's video is just deciding that the room is too bright.
When has Todd Alba been accused of being too bright? I mean, really there? I'm like, where's Aaron with the rim shot?
The Todd Alba Show. Weekday afternoons from 1 till 3 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the app. Up North News Radio with Pat Kreitlow.
I have Corrine Hendrickson, part of the Wisconsin Early Childhood Action Needed group.
The Joint Finance Committee, again in the middle of the night, took that out and said, well, hey, you have all this money coming from the federal government. Why don't you use that to create this program? Well, guess what? We proved it worked. Wages went up $2 an hour. There actually are a couple extra childcare businesses open now than there were about a year ago. And that's going to stop. Just Monday, we lost two.
Weekday morning, 6 till 8 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the app.
When you're high, you feel different. You think different, you talk different, you draw different, you listen to music different, but you probably knew that. Problem is, you also drive different, and not in a good way. That's why driving high is illegal everywhere. So if you're high, just don't drive. Make a plan to get a sober ride. Because if you feel different, you drive different. Brought to you by NHTSA and the Ad Council.
People won't give you the real talk on drugs, but it's time we know the facts. Fentanyl is killing people. It's a powerful opioid, often made illegally and commonly mixed with illicit drugs. It can even be present.
For Civic Media News, I'm Terry Bell. Many of the most recent crimes former President Donald Trump is accused of committing allegedly happened in Wisconsin or with the help of people from here. New Mexico is another battleground state caught up in the alleged fake elector scheme. Roz Brown reports.
New Mexico is one of seven battleground states where former President Donald Trump and his Republican allies are accused of trying to persuade state officials to illegally swing the last election in his favor. David Becker with the Center for Election Innovation and Research says as the next contest approaches, election workers still face fallout from 3 years ago.
They are still suffering. They are still being harassed. They are still being attacked. That's the state we're in now. In early August, 15 months before a presidential election.
New Mexico's five fake electors have yet to be charged with any crimes related to their interference. The indictment appears to suggest that the effort in New Mexico was not as involved as those in other states, such as Arizona, Georgia, or Wisconsin, where electors were asked to sign certificates, falsely stating that Trump, not Democrat Joe Biden, had won their states. Becker knows Americans are eager for an outcome in the court cases stemming from 2020, but hopes both Republicans and Democrats will eventually be on the same page.
That we as Americans can say, regardless of who engaged in these activities, if they are proven to be true beyond a reasonable doubt in a court of law, if those are true, can't we all as Americans agree that this has gone too far, that this should never happen again?
Becker, whose organization provides pro bono legal counsel to election officials, says he's already gotten requests from nearly half the states this year. This is Roz Brown. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
You're listening to Civic Media News. I'm Terry Bell.
People won't give you the real talk on drugs, but it's time we know the facts. Fentanyl is killing people. It's a powerful opioid, often made illegally and commonly mixed with illicit drugs. It can even be pressed into counterfeit pills that resemble prescription medications. Just 2 milligrams, about the size of a few grains of sand, can potentially be lethal. This isn't an ad to scare you, but it is an ad to make you think twice. Get the facts. Go to realdealonfentanyl.com. This message is brought to you by the Ad Council.
It's never personal, only politics. The Devil's Advocates Radio Show with Dom and Crute. Weekdays from 4 until 6 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the Civic Media app. 93.5, The Tap. 93.5, The Tap. 93.5, The Tap.
Thanks for listening to your local Civic Media radio station. Learn more on our website, civicmedia.us.
And this is producer Anya from Morning Cannolis. Today's episode is pre-recorded, so no need to call in, but you can always text your thoughts into us through the app. I will send them to Jim for next week. Enjoy!
And this is Morning Cannolis. My name is Jim Santel. Thank you for joining me this morning for this second hour of a very important broadcast, talking as we did before the break, and again throughout this hour, and yes, into next Saturday's broadcast as well, about the content, the focus, the meaning, the import of this major indictment returned by a federal grand jury on August 1. We spent a lot of time chatting about that and talking about what it means, the specific aspects of it, and also chatting about calendars, which we began to do right before the break between our first and our second hours. I identified October 2nd of 2023 as this date upon which the state attorney general's civil fraud case is scheduled to begin in the state of New York. That's a civil case. That is not a federal case brought by the New York attorney general. Jack Smith, seeking to grab the date of January 2nd, the first business date of the next year, for the start of the trial, this major January 6th trial based upon his indictment. We will see whether or not Judge Tanya Chutkan adopts that date. Highly likely, from my own experience, that that date will not hold, that will perhaps move well into 2024, maybe beyond that as well. We'll see how all of those things that have yet to happen, including the filing of motions, the conduct of hearings, on all kinds of things in advance of the trial, how far those go, how much time they consume. We'll see if that happens. But there's more also in January of 2024, some of these a bit more certain. We know that on January 15th of 2024, E. Jean Carroll's second civil case, again in federal court, alleging once again defamation by the former president based upon things he said while he was the president of the United States of America about her, specifically denying any sexual assault, any rape of her back in the mid-1990s in this Bergdorf Goodman store in Manhattan. We know already that she's gotten a multi-million dollar judgment against him and a first trial based upon the resurrection of claims under New York law. This is a case that actually predated that case, but it's based upon the recent decision of the attorney general not to continue to defend the president as a part of his regular duties and responsibilities as a former president, basically saying, you're on your own now. That case, that second federal defamation case, again pending in federal court, January 15th of 2024. There's another case also happening in January of 2024, January 29th. I suspect many of you have not heard about this one. This one's brought as a federal class action against, it is civil in nature, like the attorney general's case we talked about before. It's civil fraud, and it's alleging a pyramid scheme by the Trump entities and by Trump individuals, a pyramid scheme that, again, in New York court, a federal class action case set to begin on January 29th, 2024, brought by a number of individuals seeking recovery for their damages in this scheme. That's in January of 2024. We then go to March 25th in particular of 2024. This is the date on which the Manhattan DA, his name is Alvin Bragg, has with the court set for the trial of these 34 felony counts involving the payment of hush monies to this porn star Stormy Daniels, alleging falsification of documents. Again, this is a criminal case. It's in the state system, not the federal system. And right now, it is scheduled for March 25th of 2024. Interesting, Alvin Bragg has recently said that in the context of all of these other things going on, including not in any way to understate it, the significance of this recently returned indictment that Jack Smith would like to try on January 2nd, Alvin Bragg has said that he would be willing to agree to a postponement, a rescheduling of that trial to ensure that these other trials, at least one of them, proceeds. And again, prosecutors don't do that independent of a court. All of these dates set and established by courts, and if they move, it is also with the express understanding and the express consent of the judges who are presiding over them. Then we go to May 20th, 2024, and we go south. This one is in the Southern District of Florida. We've talked a lot about this one. We spent a lot of time on this broadcast talking about the specifics of the so-called Mar-a-Lago indictment. 40 felony counts against the former president, Donald Trump, alleging not only the possession, the taking of documents to which he was not entitled, but again, with a superseding indictment alleging obstruction of justice. We've spent a lot of time going through that indictment. The date set by a federal district court judge, her name is Eileen Cannon, May 20th of 2024, many months from now, May 20th of 2024, for that case, like others, the prosecutors, again, this is also a part of Jack Smith's team. Jack Smith also indicating in that case, like the January 6th prosecution, that will take weeks to present. Right now, scheduled for May 20th of 2024 in the Southern District of Florida. And then we have a couple of other things that are also out there. We know with high probability that sometime in the next week, maybe 10 days, maybe 14 days at the outside, that there's also going to be another indictment coming out of Fulton County, Georgia. This is, again, going to be a state court prosecution, almost certainly a criminal prosecution, based upon what we know about grand juries in that particular part of our nation, being pursued by the DA there. Her name is Fani Willis. We know that she has all but signaled that sometime very soon there is going to be the return or proposed return by the grand jury there of matters, again, related to January 6th, but much broader than that. Georgia election fraud, focusing on the attempts by the former president and almost certainly many others to affect to the detriment of the voters in Georgia, the counting of votes in that state, probably an indictment being returned sometime in the next week or so, maybe alleging along the way 17 to 18 possible defendants. We don't know. An awful lot of indication from Fani Willis that she is going to go very broadly, unlike Jack Smith in the sort of companion case, the federal case now pending in the D.C. District Court, naming just one defendant. But Fani Willis probably going much broadly. We'll see about that next week. And again, in our broadcast next Saturday, we will certainly talk a lot about that one. And then, of course, we also know that in the state of Michigan, not involving the former President Donald Trump, but the attorney general there has indicted 16 defendants based upon their involvement in the so-called fake or false electors scheme that we're going to talk about in great detail in the remainder of this hour. And then also in the broadcast next Saturday as well. We know that the next proceeding in that Michigan case has been charged. We do not have a trial date for that. That, again, a state prosecution, a state criminal prosecution by the state AG there. Another hearing coming up in August 18th, so very, very soon. And we'll see what happens there as well. That is your exhaustive rule of law calendar as far as we know it right now, based upon things revolving around our former president, many things involving his activities before he became president, many of them while he was president, that is the January 6th events before and after that, and again, even some of them related to events after that. Much of what E. Jean Carroll is alleging are events that have been resurrected, if you will, by the president, former president, based upon his most recent comments. All of that coming up on the docket of America in 2023, this year, the fall of this year, and extending well into 2024. I will also say that all of this, again, subject to change and extension, the judges, the federal judges, the state judges, civil and criminal, have great responsibility and great authority to change the dates. It is almost certain that many, if not all, of these dates will shift.
But in the times ahead, we know that judges are looking at these seriously and promising to the American people and also the defendant, again, presumed innocent until proven guilty, that something approaching the execution of justice will also include some movement toward disposition with all deliberate speed. There is a Speedy Trial Act in the federal system that contemplates 70 days after an initial appearance, the trial must begin. Plainly, in those federal cases already prosecuted, already underway by Jack Smith, those trial dates, those mandates under the Speedy Trial Act will not be followed. But judges, again, can make findings under that particular law to ensure that the cases are pursued in a way that justice is accomplished, and they can extend that date quite dramatically. And that's the reason why already we have got dates that are set far beyond the initial period of 70 days after an initial appearance here. Anticipate that many, many, if not all of these dates will also move forward in the calendar of America. In the times ahead, in this broadcast, and again, coming up in our next broadcast next Saturday, we're going to spend some time talking about this August 1 indictment. We know that former President Donald J. Trump was indicted on Tuesday, August 1. The indictment was returned, was made public that date based upon the results of the grand jury review of evidence presented by Jack Smith, by the Department of Justice, special counsel in this matter, a federal grand jury sitting in the District of Columbia. Again, what is a grand jury? It's 26 people, and they are called together. They are supposed to convene to review evidence of criminal conduct, and they are the ones in the end that determine whether or not charges will be brought against any defendant, including this particular defendant, Donald Trump. An important point to make when people talk about, well, this is the Attorney General, this is Jack Smith, this is the Biden administration who is pursuing these charges, certainly being prosecuted by the Department of Justice and the prosecutors, the special counsel. But the ultimate check is in our Constitution, which is a grand jury of people in our communities, bankers, teachers, masons, healthcare providers, educators, artists, people across the board brought in to determine whether or not there's probable cause to find that the allegations set forth in a proposed indictment, the evidence presented to them, does support a return of charges against a particular defendant. And so let's talk about that indictment returned by this federal grand jury earlier this month. The indictment, again, brought in the federal district court in Washington, D.C., which is also where it'll be tried, again, before Judge Chutkan, accuses Donald Trump of three principal conspiracies, four charges, but three principal conspiracies, one of them to defraud the United States, a second to obstruct an official government proceeding, and that's specifically the certification of the Electoral College vote, and a third conspiracy to deprive people of a civil right, and that is the right to have their votes counted. I was asked recently, how does one get one's right to legitimacy in voting? And the answer is under that kind of a prosecution. This third conspiracy alleged in the indictment to deprive the American people of their civil rights, the right to have their votes counted. And as a part of the fourth charge in this indictment, Donald Trump also charged with this count of obstructing or attempting to obstruct an official proceeding. That also, of course, being the conduct of the counting of votes by the United States Congress, Nancy Pelosi, the former Speaker of the House of Representatives, and Mike Pence, the former vice president. Each of those conspiracies were built upon a widespread mistrust of the defendant that was being created through a pervasive and destabilizing lies about election fraud. That's what the indictment alleges. When we come back, more on all of that right here on Morning Cannolis.
Does your financial strategy include your hopes and dreams? What matters most to you? For over 100 years, ThriveFund has helped clients like you find financial solutions for life's important goals. Explore a full range of options, from financial advice and investments to insurance, banking, and generosity programs. To have a heart-to-heart about your finances, contact Mandy Roberts, who you may recognize as Mandy Wright. Call her at 715-470-1303. 715-470-1303. Mandy Roberts proudly serves the Central Wisconsin area. For more details, visit therifens.com/disclosure.
The Maggie Dawn Show.
I would be remiss if I didn't say that some of what we do in government always is political. It has policy impacts. It has political impacts. But if your raison d'etre and your organizing principle is that my guy wins and your guy loses, the entire country suffers. That is not our call to serve. That is not what we raise our hand and say an oath.
The Maggie Dawn Show, Monday through Friday at 6 p.m. on your local Civic Media radio station and on the Civic Media app.
AM Radio provides always-on news, sports, talk, traffic, and weather reports. It also delivers vital emergency information when your community needs it most. A new bill in Congress would ensure AM Radio stays in your car, because when cell and internet services are down, this free emergency service is critical. Text AM to 52886 and tell Congress to support the AM Radio for Every Vehicle Act.
Message and data rates may apply. You may receive up to 4 messages a month, and you may text STOP to STOP.
This message furnished by the National Association of Broadcasters.
With your forecast, I'm Corey Hartman. For today, mostly sunny, a high near 82. Mostly clear tonight, lows around 58. Showers and thunderstorms possible on your Sunday with a high of 78. Showers are likely Sunday night. Some heavy rainfall is possible. Lows around 60 degrees. Monday, showers and storms in 71.
Right now, 71 degrees.
Looking for more local programming? Check out our website, civicmedia.us, to see our entire lineup.
Recorded.
And we are back here in Morning Cannolis as we begin our second hour here. Just a few moments ago, begin to describe the significance of this January 6th indictment returned on August 1 of this year against a singular defendant, Donald Trump, and talking about specifically the charges in this 45-page indictment. I would offer that this statement about the purpose of this attempt to destabilize our government and perpetuate this election fraud, targeting once again, according to the allegations in this grand jury indictment, a bedrock function of the United States federal government. Again, all this language in the indictment brought by the grand jury, the nation's process of collecting, counting, and certifying the results of the presidential election. That is an extraordinary moment. This is an extraordinary moment in United States history. This is a former president in the midst of a campaign to return to the White House, who's been charged by a federal grand jury, again in the District of Columbia, over attempts to use the very levers of government to subvert democracy and remain in office against the will of voters. This is an extraordinary time. This is an extraordinary time in our nation's history. And in very sweeping terms, as we're going to discuss in the remaining time this morning and again next Saturday as well, this indictment describes how Donald Trump and, yes, six other people, unnamed, although we know who they are, co-conspirators employed, they invoked, they applied a variety of means to reverse his defeat in the election almost from the moment that voting ended. This indictment, this extraordinary time, this extraordinary document describes how Donald Trump and these others promoted these false claims of fraud, how they sought to bend the Justice Department towards supporting these claims, using the Department of Justice as a mechanism for ensuring that he stayed in power, and then overseeing the scheme, also described with great particularity, to create this false slate of electors pledged to him in states, including Wisconsin, that were actually won by, of course, the real president, Joseph Biden. All of that, very, very compelling. And again, describes during the course of this indictment, as we will get to, how along the way, as a part of these overall schemes, these three conspiracies in four different counts, how the former president ultimately pressured the vice president, Mike Pence, to use those fake electors to subvert the certification of the election in this joint session of Congress that was going on January 6th of 2021. Of course, that was cut short by the violence of the Capitol, but not stopped completely. We know well that late into the night, the counting resumed, and indeed, America's democracy was preserved that day. But this allegation, all these allegations, describe with great particularity the attempt by the former president to undermine that process and stop it from happening. Many of the details on these charges were familiar. They've appeared not only in news accounts and also significantly in the work of the House Select Committee. Remember that group that returned its report at the end of the last calendar year? They investigated the January 6th event, and there were descriptions in the course of that presentation on Capitol Hill of Donald Trump's attempts, among other things, to use the Department of Justice, as I just said, as a mechanism for keeping himself in power, this independent agency, using the Department of Justice, attempting to do it principally through installing a loyalist, this fellow named Jeffrey Clark, who was serving in a major role, a supervisory role, and appears to be one of the co-conspirators in the case. We'll get to that in just a few moments. Wanted to put him in top of the Justice Department, replacing the acting attorney general at that time, putting Jeffrey Clark in his place, again, to be a part of this overall scheme to stop the counting of votes and to keep Donald Trump in power. There are also references along the way to Donald Trump posting a message on Twitter in mid-December of 2020, sometime after the election, calling for a wild, that is his word, a wild protest in Washington, D.C. on January 6th. We know, of course, all about that. We've heard about that before. That's also alleged in the indictment. And to also him pressuring the vice president, Mike Pence, to try to throw the election his way during that joint session of Congress. We're going to spend some time talking about the Pence components of this indictment. They're chilling. They're stunning. But the indictment, again, in that very area also contains some snippets of some new information that we have not seen before, such as this. Along the way, there's a description of Donald Trump telling Mike Pence, "You're too honest." This, of course, when Mike Pence is pushing back on these repeated attempts by the president to get Mike Pence to throw the election. The vice president pushing back on Donald Trump's pressure to interfere in the certification of Joe Biden's victory. And among the other new things we see in this indictment also includes an account of Donald Trump telling someone who asked if he wanted additional pressure to be put on Mr. Pence, he's saying no one else but him needed to speak with the vice president. In other words, he's the only one who will speak with the vice president, obviously attempting once again to compel, unsuccessfully in the end, to compel the president not to go ahead with the proper counting of those votes. As we will see, Mike Pence standing up to the president on multiple occasions and saying the Constitution does not permit me to do that, Mr. President, and denying that power and telling him no. Significantly, the indictment also includes, of course, some language related to the Ellipse event itself, that rally right before the riot at the Capitol, the insurrection. But it's not about that particular event. And the events on the Ellipse and the statements made there, while they're referenced in here, are not the premise for the charges against this defendant. When we come back, I'll tell you more about that. We'll talk more about the First Amendment and what is in this indictment right after this break.
Civic Media radio stations providing your news, conversations, and fun you won't find anywhere else.
CBS News Brief. The number of deaths from those wildfires in Maui is still rising. It's the deadliest natural disaster there in decades, and officials on the island say it's been tough, but people are pulling together.
We're a very tight-knit community. We love and respect everyone around here, and it's tough to see people go through this. This is going to be a long, hard-fought battle to get through this.
A 3-year-old migrant has died on a bus of asylum seekers being sent from Texas to Chicago. KHOU reporter Lynn Cannon.
In a statement, the Texas Division of Emergency Management said, in part, quote, once the child presented with health concerns, the bus pulled over and security personnel called 911 for emergency attention.
Illinois Supreme Court has upheld the state's ban on semi-automatic weapons.
Residents who legally own the banned guns and magazines are able to keep them, but the weapons must be registered with law enforcement. The most popular gun targeted is the AR-15 rifle.
That's WBBM's Mallory Warbroker, CBS News Brief. I'm Allison Keys.
Larry, it's your mom. Did you know the Civic Media Network covers the whole state of Wisconsin? They can help your business get the word out, whether you want to reach a smidge of folks or just want the whole kit and caboodle.
Here's what you need to know in northwestern Wisconsin. Barron County officials said the Marathon County Bomb Squad was called in to get rid of dynamite found near Rice Lake on Wednesday. The sheriff's department said an outbuilding had to be destroyed as well due to it containing materials that could easily catch on fire or explode. According to a release, the property owners had no idea there was dynamite in the outbuilding. A Cumberland man was sentenced to 4 years of probation for stealing rebate checks while he worked as a mail carrier. Joshua Kopis is accused of swiping 30 Menards rebate checks totaling $4,500 from people on his route. Kopis pleaded guilty to mail theft by a postal employee and will have to pay all of the money back. A Neillsville man was sentenced to prison for killing a highway worker while he was driving drunk. Ray Neumuller will spend 10 years in prison for killing Russell Opelt and seriously injuring David Murphy while they were working to remove a tree in the road near Greenwood in 2021. Neumuller pleaded guilty to the charges of homicide and causing injury by intoxicated use of a vehicle back in April. For Civic Media News, I'm Jimmy Kuska.
Larry, it's your mom. Did you know the Civic Media Network covers the whole state of Wisconsin? They can help your business get the word out, whether you want to reach a smidge of folks or just want the whole kit and caboodle. Call 608-819-8255. Okay then, bye.
Did you know the Wisconsin State Fair is 172 years old? It still celebrates the industries important to our state's history, like agriculture. But every year, new attractions and items are added. This year, there's more than 100 new foods to try. So what do you think topped the culinary list last year? Flamin' hot Cheetos chicken on a stick? Deep fried old fashioned? Or Pino pretzel popper brat? The answer's coming up. The Wisconsin State Fair didn't start in its current home of West Alice. The first was in Janesville along the Rock River, then moved to different locations the next 40 years. The original cream puff has been around almost as long. Close to 400,000 are gobbled up every year. So which food was number one last year? It was the Pino pretzel popper brat. It came out on top. The State Fair is a true slice of Wisconsin, and it runs through August 13th. I'm Terry Barr for the Civic Media Radio Network.
More than 80 million Americans depend on AM radio each month for news, weather, and emergency information. A new bill in Congress would make sure AM radio remains in cars, because when cell and internet services are down, this free service could be your only lifeline. Text AM to 52886 and tell Congress to support the AM Radio for Every Vehicle Act.
Message and data rates may apply. You may receive up to 4 messages a month, and you may text STOP to STOP.
This message furnished by the National Association of Broadcasters.
Hey, I'm Smokey Bear, and I made an assistant to help you out, because only you can prevent wildfires.
Hey, Assistant Smokey Bear.
Welcome back. Again, this is Morning Cannolis. We are spending this second hour and a good portion of our next broadcast next Saturday talking about the Trump January 6th indictment returned by a federal grand jury on August 1 of this year. And right before the break, talking in broad terms about the big themes coming out of this particular indictment. We're going to go into those in greater depth in just a few moments or so. Plainly, the indictment, including the references to January 6th itself, the riot, the insurrection at the Capitol, and right before that, this rally at the Ellipse near the White House itself, in which Donald Trump called upon his followers to go to the Capitol and stop the counting of those votes. We know what happened as a result of that. The indictment, although it describes some of those events again, is not premised upon that articulation of that advocacy there. While it does, in fact, identify the things that Donald Trump and others said and mentions Trump's exploitation of the violence and the chaos at the building that day, that's from the language of the indictment, it does not significantly accuse the president of inciting the riot. We've seen that in other cases, right? We've seen the seditious conspiracy charges. We've got about 1,100 people charged with actually attacking the Capitol, entering into it, and we've talked about many of those cases as well. Significantly, this indictment does not charge the defendant, Donald Trump, with inciting that riot, but many, many other things. It also sets forth how Donald Trump repeatedly told multiple people, including top officials in his campaign at the Department of Justice, that he had lost the election and that his claims that he had been cheated out of this somehow had to be vindicated. And the indictment sets forth in great detail, and we're going to spend some time talking about this, how that belief, how that statements, those statements were not only false, but had to be false in the mind of the former president based upon all the things that were set forth in the indictment and things that are being said to him. And the significance of that, as we will talk, establishing that all these accusations are supported and provide evidence of the former president's intent in doing what he did, namely to stay in power and to get all these other people, including the vice president, including fake electors, including people at the Department of Justice and others, to do his work to keep him in power, knowing in fact that he did not win the election. And with this specific intent only to keep himself in power. The indictment says that his constant claims of widespread election fraud were, according to the indictment, false, and the defendant knew they were false. And it goes on to add that he was told repeatedly, as I just indicated, that his assertions were indeed untrue. The indictment says, despite having lost, the defendant was determined to remain in power, which again is a key element of the indictment itself. One of the key themes of the indictment. And now we're going to go into the indictment and provide a little bit more meat on those bones, talk more about the specifics of those kinds of large themes, what this indictment is all about. Again, four counts: conspiracy to defraud the United States, conspiracy to obstruct an official proceeding, obstruction of an attempt to obstruct an official proceeding, and conspiracy against rights. That last one under 18 U.S.C. Section 241, often used. Again, in civil rights prosecutions. Significantly, the indictment, 45 pages, begins with the fundamental notion that Donald Trump lost the 2020 presidential election. One of the shortest statements in the entire indictment, it's right there on the first page of the indictment. Very thoughtfully, getting back to this ellipse reference, and specifically to this continuing allegation, this maintenance by many of the president's, former president's defenders, that the prosecution of the former president obstructs and impinges in some way his First Amendment rights to speak publicly. Let's talk about what the indictment says and what it doesn't say about that First Amendment challenge to the allegations against the former president. Paragraph 3, here is how that reads. Coming from the grand jury, it says this: the defendant, Donald Trump, had a right, like every American, it says, to speak publicly about the election and even to claim falsely that there had been outcome determinative fraud during the election and that he had won. Outcome determinative meaning things that happened that resulted in clarity on who won this election. An affirmation right at the start of this indictment that nothing about this impinges upon, affects the defendant's First Amendment rights on the day of the ellipse presentation of that rally. And he had every right to do that, to speak about this before, during January 6th and after. It goes on to say this: he was also entitled to formally challenge the results of the election through lawful and appropriate means, such as by seeking recounts or audits of the popular vote in states or filing lawsuits challenging ballots and procedures, affirming in this indictment the former president's rights to do that, to petition government, petition courts to overturn the election as he wanted to have it done. He had that right to seek recourse in the federal and state courts. And the indictment goes on to say, indeed, in many cases, the defendant did pursue those methods of contesting the election results. His efforts, it goes on to say, to change the outcome in any state through recounts, audits, or legal challenges were uniformly successful. I would offer that paragraph number 3, it's on the second page of the indictment, is one of the most important issues presentations in this entire document, because it sets forth again the notion that nothing about the charges in this indictment, the four charges that I've recited here that are very clear in this indictment, nothing about those in any way implicates the First Amendment. You have a right to say these things. What you don't have the right to do, and this is the defense that Jack Smith will plainly rally not only in court but in pretrial motions as well, is what you don't have the right to do under the First Amendment is to commit crimes, right? For example, if I have a dispute with a bank, I can stand outside that bank and I can protest and I can present signs and scream and yell without obstructing too much of the public discourse all about that bank. I can use my First Amendment rights to advocate publicly. And I can say that bank owes me money, it's engaged in some kind of inappropriate fraud. I can say all of those things. That's what the indictment also says. What I cannot do, of course, is act in violence based upon that belief. I can't go into the bank then and rob the bank, do something, some other kind of violent activity inside or outside the bank to accomplish a violation of the federal or state criminal code. That's the distinction. And that's the distinction between all of these events that are set forth in this indictment. You have a right to say things. You cannot act on those things in a way that violates the law of our nation. And that's the significant defense that is out there, not only in the public domain, to people who understand the limits of the First Amendment, and the notion that just because you can have the right to say things and even articulate things, we will let you say things of a great variety. The Supreme Court has given all of us great breath in terms of our capacity to do those things. What the First Amendment does not do, and what the criminal law, state and federal criminal law, criminalizes, is conduct of a violent and even nonviolent nature that affects the safety and security of our nation and its people. And that's exactly what the remaining pages of this indictment set forth in great detail, the ways in which this moves beyond any First Amendment allegations, any First Amendment statements or postures, and describes the specific kinds of violence, the conspiracy to defraud the United States of America. And again, if that paragraph, number 3, makes clear the distinction between First Amendment rights and criminal acts, the paragraph number 7, again, on page 3, is arguably the second most important thing describing what this indictment is all about. It says this: the purpose of the conspiracy was to overturn the legitimate results of the 2020 presidential election by using knowingly false claims of election fraud to obstruct the federal government function by which those results are collected, counted, and certified. It's a long sentence. It is a clear dispositive sentence. It is a declarative sentence about what this indictment is all about and describing the purpose of the conspiracy, overturning the results, attempting to overturn the results of the 2020 election. Significantly, right after that, the indictment goes on to say, although the defendant is a singular defendant in this case, it's only Donald Trump. The indictment, as I said, identifies 6 other people. They're called unindicted co-conspirators. We've seen that language before. A lot of it, those of you who are old enough to remember the Watergate days will recall a lot of that reference. Unindicted co-conspirators, along with Richard Nixon and other people who are also charged. Here again, we've got that same concept. What is it? We know who these people are. They're identified by their conduct. We were able to identify them also through other indicia, even beyond the indictment. They were involved with this principal defendant, Donald Trump, in effectuating, perpetuating these conspiracies. They will almost certainly themselves at some point be charged with violations of the federal law. They're not charged in this indictment, probably for a number of good strategic reasons that Jack Smith and his staff have thought through. Wanting to bring this case to trial as expeditiously as possible and wanting to bring it to a trial, to a trial jury, in a way that's clean and neat and clear, absent, if you will, all of the other defendants who will also be charged probably in other cases. So what does this indictment again say in the first pages of it? Identifies 6 different co-conspirators. And we know again with some certainty, even though their names are not in the indictment, we know pretty much who they are, and we've seen them before in a lot of the media as well. We know that co-conspirator number 1 identified in the indictment as an attorney who was willing to spread knowingly false claims and pursue strategies that Donald Trump's 2020 reelection campaign attorneys would not. We know that that person is Rudy Giuliani. We know that that, and only because of that particular statement, but also because of other references that come up later in the indictment, his counsel has all but admitted that co-conspirator number one is Rudy Giuliani. Co-conspirator number two, described as an attorney who devised and attempted to implement a strategy to leverage the vice president's ceremonial role overseeing the counting of the certification of those votes, the certification proceeding, to obstruct the certification of the presidential election. That's co-conspirator number two. We know with great certainty that person is John Eastman, described in the past as the author, if you will, of one of the major memorandums that puts together this entire scheme involving false electors, involving going into at least six or seven states, involving state officials, attempting to involve state officials, involving the vice president, and then getting the vice president to stop the proper counting. That's John Eastman. He is also named, again, not by name, but as co-conspirator number two. Co-conspirator number three, an attorney whose unfounded claims of election fraud Donald Trump privately acknowledged to others sounded crazy, okay? And the reason why that is one of other statements here and in other things that we've seen in the public domain, indicative of the president's own knowledge that these claims of election fraud were unfounded, and affirming there, dropping right in the fourth page of this indictment, the notion that the defendant, Donald Trump, knew that those claims were crazy because he described those claims to one of the co-conspirators as being just that. Who is that co-conspirator number three? That's Sidney Powell. Sidney Powell, you remember her from a lot of the public appearances also, along with Rudy Giuliani, sometimes with John Eastman and others, in matters related to this attempt to convince America, to convince courts and others that the election had been stolen. Co-conspirator number four, a Justice Department official who worked on civil matters and who, with the defendant, Donald Trump, attempted to use the Justice Department to open sham election crime investigations. That also a part of the allegation of conspirator number four. That's Jeffrey Clark. We've already talked a little bit about him. When we come back, we'll talk more about him and the two other co-conspirators named in this indictment as unindicted co-conspirators. We know who they are. We know also about their specific involvement with the named defendant, Donald Trump, in these crimes set forth in this indictment. Stay with us for that continuing examination of this indictment.
One call, the Civic Media Network of stations can deliver your business's message to the entire state of Wisconsin.
Or your hometown.
Marketing plans that work for your business. One call can do it all. Civic Media, 608-819-8255.
It doesn't hurt, feels good to help. And when you give blood, you provide a life-saving difference for others. The need doesn't take a summer break. So we have a challenge for you, started by Civic Media's Earl Ingram.
Congratulations to all those people and all of you who donate blood.
Take a selfie while giving blood, then post it along with hashtag Civic Pints. Give blood and you could get a prize too. Find challenge details and a donation center near you at civicmedia.us/giveblood. civicmedia.us/giveblood.
Sometimes I just cannot believe all the storms we've gone through here. I can only hope that we'll be able to leave this house to you one day, baby. You're our legacy.
Planning for these disasters will make sure we're safe. And is the best way to protect that legacy.
Protect your legacy.
Visit ready.gov/plan for the tools and tips you need to start your emergency preparedness plan today. Brought to you by FEMA and the Ad Council.
Missed your favorite show? It's easy to find it wherever you listen to podcasts. Apple, Google, or civicmedia.us.
It's What's on Tap for the Chippewa Valley. 93.5 The Tap. 93.5 The Tap.
With your forecast, I'm Corey Hartman. For today, mostly sunny, a high near 82. Mostly clear tonight, lows around 58. Showers and thunderstorms possible on your Sunday with a high of 78. Showers are likely Sunday night. Some heavy rainfall is possible. Lows around 60 degrees. Monday, showers and storms in 71.
Right now, 71 degrees.
Civic Media radio stations, providing your news, conversations, and fun you won't find anywhere else.
Segment on this two-hour presentation this morning here at Morning Cannolis, talking principally, if not exclusively, about the indictment returned on August 1 by a federal grand jury in Washington, D.C., diving deeply into the specifics of this indictment, giving you some sense about the granularity of it beyond just the broad reporting of this indictment in the media and in other places. We're talking about these six unindicted, uncharged co-conspirators, nonetheless people involved with the indicted conspirator named Donald Trump. Talking about number four, again, this fellow who is inside the Department of Justice, using the department to open sham election crime investigations and influence state legislatures with knowingly false claims of election fraud. We're going to get back to that as well in our next broadcast. We know who that is. That's co-conspirator number four, Jeffrey Clark. He is also the person who attempted, if you will, a small coup inside the Department of Justice by attempting to usurp the then acting attorney general, trying to convince the president to put him in place of the acting attorney general so he could implement this scheme. That's co-conspirator number four. Co-conspirator number five, an attorney who assisted in devising and attempting to implement a plan to submit fraudulent slates of presidential electors to obstruct the certification proceeding. An attorney who was also involved in this scheme, probably not in the tips of everyone's tongue, but we've seen him before in other matters. His name is Kenneth Cheesebro, and he will also, again, loom large in the presentation of this case. And finally, co-conspirator number six, described as a political consultant who helped implement a plan to submit fraudulent slates of presidential electors to obstruct the certification proceeding. A political consultant, sort of obscure description, ultimately identified principally by the New York Times as a fellow named Boris Epstein. He was an advisor to the campaign. And those are the six. Those are the six people who are set forth in this indictment as working with the indicted president, Donald Trump, to accomplish these conspiracies. All of those things we've already hinted at in the descriptions of these co-conspirators, described in much greater detail as the indictment goes forth. A significant indictment, again, focusing not only upon this defendant, Donald Trump, but the activities of these six others who, again, will almost certainly at some point down the road likewise be involved in future charges. The indictment then goes on to talk about the manner and means by which these seven people, including named defendant Donald Trump, and these six others accomplished these charges, these three conspiracies, four different charges. How do they go about doing that? That's the manner and means description of the indictment. It is extensive. And again, like all the rest of this, I commend it to your reading. It is fascinating reading. I'm going to talk a little bit about the manner and means by which this was done and begin with this indication once again that this false or fraudulent slates of electors scheme was key to this overall operation. Again, we've seen that before. We've identified that before in much of the media. Here it's set forth with great particularity. There's a major section we're going to talk about in our next broadcast, focusing on those fake electors. Page 5, however, the manner and means begins for the most part by saying the defendant, Donald Trump, and these six co-conspirators organized fraudulent slates of electors in 7 targeted states. And again, we know that. We've seen that before in some of the reporting. Significantly, what are those states? Those states, again, identified in this indictment as Arizona, Georgia, Michigan, Nevada, New Mexico, Pennsylvania, and yes, Wisconsin as well. A significant portion of this indictment in its later pages describing that scheme, identifying those states in particular. There is a specific section about Wisconsin in this indictment, which we're going to talk about in our next broadcast. That all part of the manner and means, the important focus that these fake electors were going to play in attempting to stop the counting of votes and to return a fraudulent result in favor of Donald Trump and not Joe Biden. All of this, according to the indictment, all of that, of course, all those claims, according to the indictment, were false. And the defendant, as I said before, as recited before throughout the indictment, the defendant knew that they were, in fact, false. A clear statement in this indictment about the knowledge of this defendant, that the things he was saying publicly, and some of them, yes, are repeated in this indictment, he knew that they were false, and he knew that the things he was perpetrating on the American public were simply attempts to keep himself in power, to establish and to create a reality that was anything but that. Goes on to say, in fact, the defendant was notified repeatedly that his claims were untrue, often by the people on whom he relied for candid advice on important matters and who were best positioned to know the facts, and he deliberately disregarded the truth. Why is all of that important? And why is this section, which we're going to continue to talk about in our next broadcast, why is that so important? Because as a part of this presentation, again, Jack Smith has an obligation to prove the charges in this indictment beyond a reasonable doubt to all the members of the trial jury unanimously, right? And so one of the things he's going to have to establish is that the defendant knew that what he was doing was wrong and knew that the things that he was saying were false. And indeed, in the pages that follow, there is explicit statements about all the people who've told the president that indeed the things that he was saying publicly were false, an incredible juxtaposition of statements made to him indicating that, Mr. President, you have lost this election, and returning later that day, the following day, into the public domain and saying just the opposite. In our broadcast next week, we're going to spend a lot of time talking about that all-important aspect of knowledge, the intent set forth in this indictment. And then we're also going to talk about the specifics in places like Arizona and also Georgia and Michigan, Pennsylvania, and yes, indeed, Wisconsin. We're going to spend a fair amount of time talking about the role that the Wisconsin allegations play in this particular indictment. And then, as promised as well, we're going to spend some time talking about this false elector scheme, again, involving the state of Wisconsin, how it was that that came to be. I'm going to talk about the thing called the Wisconsin Memorandum and a fraudulent elector memorandum, and then conclude with a discussion of Mike Pence and his involvement, his pushback against the president that prevented Donald Trump from asserting and accomplishing what he wanted to do. All of that is going to be coming up in our next broadcast next Saturday as we continue this exhaustive and intensive review of this indictment that is changing America. A hugely significant event in our history for now and for the legacies to come. Join us again next week for that discussion. Thank you for being with me this Saturday for this discussion of the rule of law, the administration of law, and the aspiration for justice in America. We'll be right back.
If you care about animals or crops, you probably care how the weather could impact both.
It's summer in Wisconsin, and the success of your efforts often depends on knowing the forecast. Count on your local Civic Media weather team for all the information you need.
Crops roots are also growing deeper in search for water, which is bad news, because when rain finally falls, it will sit shallow and be absorbed in the top layers of the soil.
Your weather and more for your part of Wisconsin.
On your local Civic Media radio station and streaming on the app.
US Kids presents What to Expect When You're Expecting a Teenager. Learning the lingo.
Jelly. Jelly adjective. Jelly is a shorter, better way to say jealous. As in, Chloe, I am like so jelly of your unicorn phone case.
You don't have to speak teen to be a perfect parent. Thousands of teens in foster care will love you just the same.